This is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. As you know, we Zoom this interview. So we Zoom on Tuesday, and you will hear it on Wednesday. But as we begin our day, we begin with the powerful testimony of Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019, where he assured everyone that only in America could this kind of thing happen, that he was safe, and he assured his papa, "Don't worry, Dad. You made the right decision to come here." Of course, we forgot. He was saying that under the umbrella of Donald Trump, who is now our commander-in-chief, our liar-in-chief, and our retaliator-in-chief. Not only was Colonel Vindman not okay, but I suspect a lot of us aren't okay. But we need to hear the words of Colonel Vindman, because these are the words you need to hear as you go into the voting booth in November of 2020.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free, free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Welcome back, Vindman. I've got to meet him someday. So there's an organization called the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. And the reason I have been following this organization is because I've gotten to know John Farrell. He is the co-director of their Energy Democracy Initiative. And I am a fanatic on alternative energy. But more than that, I believe in something called the democratization of energy. And what we have come to understand is that when you look at oil and gas and coal and fracking and nuclear, guess what? Somebody else does it. It happens because they have to dig for oil, or they have to frack for oil, or they have to dig a huge nuclear power plant, or they have to dig deep and they have to find coal. What's wonderful about alternative energy is that it's accessible to all of us. The sun rises, the sun sets, but the sun produces energy. The wind blows, the wind doesn't blow, but the wind produces energy. There could be geothermal in the ground. Guess what? You could actually produce energy. You could actually do things like conservation and need even less energy. So the idea is that all of a sudden you don't need big. You actually just need to be able to do. So with that as my introduction, let me explain to you the headline, which is why John Farrell is now joining us. Why it's short-sighted to do centralized planning in a decentralizing electricity grid. John Farrell, the biggest smile on my face when I saw that headline, because it speaks on so many levels to everything I've been saying and the opportunity as we get through this pandemic, we look at new job creation, we want to address climate change, we look at a Green New Deal, we're recognizing that the oil market has just tanked, we know that coal is a thing of the past, maybe nuke should not even be in our future. This is an important story to tell and tell now, because otherwise we're going to reproduce the failures of the past as opposed to the opportunities of the future. So let me welcome you to the program.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be back.
So explain to my audience what you mean by the short-sightedness of centralized planning. Everyone has this idea that big is better, big is cheaper, big is more efficient. You want to rely on big. And, you know, and unfortunately we see things big like Facebook and big like Amazon. But when it comes to energy, although historically we've been attached to big, maybe we need to go back to the old days where there was no such thing as big. You built a fire in your fireplace or your firebox. You used whale oil to heat your, you know, to light your things. That maybe in a bizarre way, what is old is new again, but what is old is not exactly a repeat of the old, but what is new understands the value of what was old.
Yeah, I mean, really what's new again is this idea that we can get the energy we need locally, that we can find what we need to live our lives nearer at hand. And the challenge that we have right now is that our electricity system, which is about 100 years old, give or take a decade or two, has really evolved into a system of centralized planning. You know, the first power plants only served a few blocks. You know, they were really small. It was a neighborhood kind of thing to have a power station. And they grew and grew and grew because it was cost effective to do so. And as a result, we also sort of structured the whole organization of our electricity system around the notion that bigger would be better, and that both the size of the facility that made the electricity should be big, but also the owner of that electricity system should be big.
Right.
And we're now at a turning point where we continue to plan as though that truth of economics still exists, which it does not. And it means that we are missing out on opportunities to do things the right way.
Well, and the other thing is that one of the things that we're always talking about is that we have to reinforce the grid, that we have to look at this infrastructure, because if you have these big facilities, they're not in your neighborhood. They're could be hundreds of miles away. And in order to get that energy from hundreds of miles away, it has to come through a path, and that's the grid. Well, the problem with the grid is it's kind of old. You mentioned we've been doing this now for probably 100 years. It's also incredibly vulnerable. And now as we're looking at things like national security issues, it's vulnerable on 1,000 levels. It's vulnerable from computer hacking. It's vulnerable because someone could blow it up. It's vulnerable because one little place could sort of fail, and then you find out it's kind of like dominoes. A lot of other places fail because now you're connected to that failure. And so all of a sudden, instead of it being efficient and better, it is just ripe for vulnerability and making us less secure and less safe.
And it really, I think the time period we find ourselves in with coronavirus and the reliance that we have on being at home and on having energy to access the outside world, whether that's to get on the internet, to power our internet connections, the lights, the computers, the iPads, the devices. You know, my children are home from school and doing distance learning and needing access to an internet connection and to devices to connect them. And so our electricity grid has become more important than ever to allow us to continue life in this very uncertain time. And yet here we are all in our different places, separate from one another. And the opportunity is there for us to say, hey, what if we, instead of trying to reinforce a very large and vulnerable system, you know, with these few points of failure, large transmission lines or big power plants, that we have lots of different ways that we produce energy on home rooftops or from these geothermal systems or other things, where now by introducing many different producers and owners and controllers of the system, it makes it a lot harder for it to all go down at once. It makes it a lot less vulnerable to, you know, these long tail threats, if you will, from terrorism and whatnot, but also to natural disasters.
Right.
And it also provides, you know, economic benefits like reducing people's energy bills if they are also energy producers. So there are a lot of different ways that we can view this and a lot of different benefits it can bring to us to think about how do we redesign the grid in a way that aligns better with the way that we are using energy and the kinds of technology that we have to produce energy.
So, you know, as I'm listening to you, I start smiling because I keep thinking about my very wealthy brother who worked for banks. And one of the things they always talked about was diversifying your portfolio. And as you were talking, I kept thinking, whoa, I get to quote him. Diversifying your portfolio. What a business is like. They like stability, okay? They like to know what the expectation is, what the cost is. They want to know it's reliable. That's what business wants. What do people want? They want a diversified portfolio so they know that it's like even when you plant grass on your lawn, you don't want to plant one kind of seed. You want to plant lots of different kinds of seed because God forbid something goes after that one seed, you still have grass. Well, it's so funny. We talk about that in every which way, But we haven't talked about that when it comes to how we produce energy. We're sort of really stuck in this rigid mode, and you'll understand why, John. Let's remind people, if we have big facilities, we have big owners. If we have big owners, they probably have stockholders. They probably have senior management. They probably have lots of money. They probably write the rules and regulations that basically maintain their power and their wealth and their profit. And so when you're talking about more of a democratization of energy and you're talking about diversifying, you're talking about smaller, with less access to power, with less ability to sort of, you know, manipulate an outcome. And I think what's interesting about the pandemic is that it comes sandwiched between an economic failure and climate change. And that gives you a trifecta of opportunity that really didn't exist before. You've been right, John, for a long time. But now more than being right, I think this is your opportunity to be heard.
I really appreciate that. You know, I wrote another piece just about 3 weeks ago, kind of as an economic stimulus proposal called 30 million solar rooftops. But the idea that the approach here shouldn't just be to address these dual crises of the economy and climate in our stimulus, but also the economic structure that we have and the inequality that we have. And that if we invested instead in putting solar on millions of Americans' rooftops and focused in particular on those folks who are the most energy burdened, whether that's, you know, folks who are on a fixed income, folks who are in a rural community, folks who are poor, folks who run a small business, that we would really be able to accelerate our economic recovery in a way that helps everybody, but specifically help those who have suffered the most under a system that generated a lot of inequality around health, has around race, around many other things that we have a chance to solve. And we could do it with a technology that has almost universal support. Everybody loves solar. This is a great way to deal with this, but we don't have to only let the big companies and the big utilities own it. We can own it too.
You know what I would love, John? I would love you to sit down at a table, social distancing, of course, with Joe Biden. And then I want some of the utility boys to sit down at the same table with you. And I want Joe to hear the conversation, okay? I don't want to just put one side out there. I want him to hear both, okay? Recognizing what you just said, recognizing what I just said, I want to hear their argument. Okay? Because they're going to say, what about jobs? Oh, you just mentioned it. How many millions of jobs could we create by the solar panels? You know, we mentioned about the idea of the energy independence. What kind of energy independence would we have if we did solar and wind and geothermal? I mean, we wouldn't have to worry about Saudi Arabia. We wouldn't have to worry about whether Saudi decided to like have an oil war with Russia or whatever. I mean, and then you see what happens to Houston, where they lose thousands of jobs and Texas's economy goes into that. You know what? So in a lot of ways, what I would love is for both Joe to hear this conversation and for this conversation to be put on MSNBC and CNN so everybody can hear this conversation. Because this is a conversation that plays into everyone's fear of the future, but it also addresses their fear of the future. And it doesn't just address it from an energy perspective. That's what's amazing. The utilities only address energy and their profits. Look what you address. You address so much more.
It's really, you know, you opened our conversation by mentioning Amazon. And I think it's really interesting. Amazon's been in the news recently, for example, because on their platform with the data access they have, a lot of these independent businesses that use Amazon as a way to get to customers. I mean, half of all internet shopping searches start at Amazon.com, not on Google or Yahoo or any of the search engines anymore. So if you want to sell, you kind of have to be on their platform. And they use that to steal information about the customers of those businesses and then to make a copy of that product and sell it under their own brand name. And you know what? Utilities do the same thing. Utilities are doing a thing called self-scheduling. We have competitive markets for electricity at the transmission level where we, you know, these big power plants are supposed to be competing, but utilities are allowed to schedule which power plants are called must run, which means that they are needed for reliability. And recent research has shown that they actually use that as a way of shielding big coal plants and big other fossil fuel power plants from competition in the market by saying, we have to run these. They're essential to the grid, even though they are more expensive, usually than clean energy options like wind and solar that are available on our grid system instead. And there are a lot of other ways that utilities, you know, they've got a lot of lobbyists, they have a lot of relationships in terms of how the rules of the system are written. I could go on and on, but I think people kind of understand that at a gut level, right? Like right. These big companies have too much political power. They have too much money. It allows them to, unlevel the playing field, to take advantage of us. And that if we're able to distribute the way that we produce energy, it will inherently weaken the power of those big players because they will have competition and customers will have choices. And
that's,
I think
so
that's at the heart of it.
Capitalistic of you, competition. Oh my God. The only people that like socialism actually aren't the socialists. It's the large utilities. They want to control everything and therefore you don't exist. God forbid you compete. I mean, it's so ironic what we're talking about, because when you really want to talk about socialism, let me introduce you to a number of power utilities and you'll understand what I'm talking about. But as we're talking about the alternatives and we're talking about, you know, what it means for safety and security, and maybe we don't have to invest in that old grid infrastructure and repair it because we can look at something less centralized, more decentralized. But also, even within the alternative energy, there are choices. You could have a huge solar array. You could have the little 18 solar panels on my roof. You could have community solar. Tell me about those choices, because there's also the idea of big, even within the alternative energy business. And I want to know, is there a sweet spot? Is there a way for us to still keep it a little more bottom up, a little more personal, a little more community? Because the idea that I can have this huge array of solar panels is a lovely thing, but is that really the goal? Or is the goal to really not have to have it remote and far, but close and near?
You know, you've really struck on what I find to be in a way, kind of a wedge issue in the climate movement, where there are some folks who say, at any price, we need to solve climate change. And therefore, we can't spend our time talking about who owns things and how big things are, because this problem is too urgent and too pressing. And the irony of that is that the small stuff can actually get us there faster in many cases. So number one, you know, and we've done an analysis of this. It's something I published a number of years ago. We compared Germany to the United States. Germany has about as much solar as we do on a per capita basis, but it's almost all smaller. It's almost all on customer rooftops, on farms, all that kind of thing, owned by individual Germans or Germans in cooperatives working together. I mean, all of the kind of things that we would like to see in terms of how we distribute the benefits of clean energy. And they deployed that amount of solar that's competitive with the amount that we have over the same time frame, even though it was smaller. And that's actually something that we've learned. You know, you can see that now. Like if the big utility in my state, Xcel Energy, wants to build a big solar array, it's going to probably take them a year or two between the process of getting permission, getting permits, getting environmental impact statement. It took 6 weeks to put solar on my rooftop from the day they showed up to the day it was done and turned on and I was producing electricity. It's so much faster. Right. And so we have a speed advantage in terms of confronting the problems, but we also have a cost advantage. And this is something we don't get to talk about a lot. So a utility will talk about, you know, small solar costs more than big solar. And it's absolutely true from the standpoint of when I put my electrons on the grid, they cost more to produce from my rooftop than they do from the utility. But the advantage of my solar is that it's actually producing energy right where we use it. So think about Amazon. Would I pay for two-day delivery if I still had to drive 20 miles to go pick up the package? No, it's because it's actually delivered right to me. And that's what solar is doing on my rooftop. And that it can't, that the big solar can't compete with. And in fact, there are a lot of costs that are hidden when they quote you the cost of that big solar, because they don't talk about the shipping and handling fees to get it from that big solar array down to you. And so what we've actually found is that when we compare, number one is that it's really stupid to compare big and small because they have these different characteristics. They really compete in different markets. One is, you know, delivered to your doorstep, and the other one is competing out in a wholesale market against other big power plants, gas power plants and coal power plants. And what we've found is that solar wins in both places. It is cheaper for me to produce solar on my own rooftop than it is to buy power from the utility to deliver to my door in many, many places across our country. And it is also cheaper for the utility to build a really big solar array. The other thing I think that's important too is that it is the cost. So I mentioned that we don't want to compare big and small specifically, but if we do, if we decide to go down that road, it's also true that there is like a sweet spot. You know, if you build a solar array of about 5 megawatts, it's enough to serve maybe like 2,000 homes. it might be the size of like 5 Walmart rooftops, for example. Okay. We find that that's actually the cheapest kind of solar you can build in terms of size, more so than the stuff on individual rooftops and much more so than the really big stuff, because it can plug in lots of available spaces on the grid. We can use our existing infrastructure. We don't have to build that new transmission line to get to the big stuff, but we do also get some economies of scale combining all those little projects into a bigger one. And we can use that for things like community solar instead of individual solar. So there's lots of people who don't have a sunny rooftop they can put solar on.
Exactly.
They can buy into one of these community solar arrays that's actually the most cost-effective solar we can produce.
And let's also be honest, I don't know what it cost you, but it was pretty expensive for me to put on my solar panels. And I was lucky, there was the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, so I was able to get some kind of a grant from that and, you know, whatever. And I was able to use some of my aunt's money, you know, we were all able to cobble it together. But a lot of people don't have that opportunity, and a lot of people don't have that income. They may be paying an enormous amount in property taxes, which is consuming 20% of their income. There's no way they're putting the whatever the initial investment is in that. Is there a way for us through like the community investment kind of thing where who owns those community panels? Are they owned by still like a little tiny mini utility? Are they owned cooperatively? If I'm low income, do I get to buy in? How do we, my biggest fear is all these lovely ideas usually don't always understand the needs of really low income people who have the greatest financial burden, because the cost of their energy usually is significant given their income. And yet if they're going to do these alternative things, it is not necessarily a switch they can just switch on, because there's usually a buy-in. So how do I envision this, but make sure that they benefit, not just benefit from the lack of pollution from the oil, coal, and gas, but benefit because they too get to be own a piece of that alternative energy?
Let me tell you about two things that sound very similar that help address this problem. One is the notion of pay as you go. And so a lot of community solar projects that we've seen in Minnesota, which is the state that has the most of them, are on this pay as you go model, where I don't have to put down any money up front. I literally just pay through my electric bill a payment to the developer of the solar project. And I also then receive the savings from that solar project that I've invested on my bill. So generally I have, you know, I might lower my bill by say 5 or 10% from day one. Mm-hmm. And then I'm able to make those payments over the length of 10 or 15 or even 20 years. So I can sign up that way and reduce my bill. Now, the problem is exactly what you mentioned. If you don't have a good credit score, or if you are low income, they may not want to sign you up. And so the other one is called pay as you save. This is actually a trademark name for something that we call inclusive energy financing. And the idea is, can we let people pay for things that save them money on their electric bill or their energy bill writ large through their electric bill itself? So can we finance solar that way? Can we finance wall insulation and attic insulation? Can we finance energy efficient?
How does that work?
The idea is, so a really successful rural electric cooperative, a number of them do this, but this one is in Arkansas. It's called Wachita Electric. And what they do is they're borrowing money at very low interest from the federal government. They use it to pay for the improvements on the customer's property, for the insulation and that kind of stuff. And the customer just pays it back on their bill to the utility. And it's always that payment back to the utility is always a little bit less than the savings. So customer is saving money on their bill. They're getting energy efficiency improvements in their home or solar on their home. So they're saving money. They're doing good things. But everybody's benefiting because, of course, the utility has to buy less energy itself. And so Wachita Electric is just one example of many utilities that are using this kind of program. They're saying, hey, let's leverage our power, the capital that we have.
Yep.
Let's make investments for everybody, but we can do this and we don't have to worry about your credit score because you're a customer of ours and we're going to make investments that are going to cut your bill. You're going to be able to pay your bill because it's going to be lower. So let's go out and
John,
do that for everybody.
We got to talk again. You can tell I love this topic. And this topic is so important now. It is so important now. I'm going to do a shout out into the ether. Get John to sit in front of Joe Biden. Get the utilities to sit at the same table. Have the conversation. Understand what a win-win-win this is. And now is the time to have the conversation, because never have we felt so vulnerable, especially because we're home. And now we understand that we need that reliability. We also need that savings, and we have to address climate change. John Farrell, I am so glad you're the co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance and you direct the Energy Democracy Initiative. The title of his piece sounded wonky, but oh my God, it's amazing. Why it's short-sighted to do centralized planning in a decentralizing electricity grid. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much. It's always a pleasure.
All right. Stick around, everyone. When we come back after a break, one of our faves, Mel Goodman. I was thinking Pompeo. And whose name came into my head? Goodman. We'll be right back.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1938. That was the day unemployed workers began a sit-down strike at the post office in Vancouver, British Columbia. They had been organized by the communist-led Relief Project Workers Union during the Great Depression. In Canada, federally funded works projects had been administered at the provincial level. By late 1937, the Prime Minister began to cut funding. Unable to financially sustain the projects alone, provincial Premier Thomas Petillo ended the works project for British Columbia. Masses of unemployed men thrown off their jobs, some driven to homelessness, organized occupations of the Hotel Georgia, the Vancouver Art Gallery, and the main post office to protest the cuts. While hotel owners paid protesters to leave, the occupation at the gallery and the post office lasted for weeks. Finally, on Father's Day, June 18th, gallery occupiers were driven out with tear gas. The post office strikers were met with much more violence. Royal Canadian Mounted Police led the assault with tear gas and forcibly dragging of sit-downers out of the building. Once evicted, they were met with the batons of local police. Organizers were singled out for especially severe beatings, and scores were hospitalized for their injuries. One striker, Arthur Redseth, had an eye knocked out, while his fellow sit-downer had his jaw broken for asking authorities to call an ambulance for his friend. Strike leader Steve Brody suffered permanent eye damage as well. News of the terror spread throughout the city, and by mid-afternoon, 10 to 15,000 protesters gathered to express outrage at what became known as Bloody Sunday in Vancouver. Premier Petillo denounced the strikers as having received too much sympathy. He nonetheless used the debacle as an opportunity to get federal funds reinstated. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show.
Ludlow tends to Peterloo. Tyrants do what tyrants do. Only thing that brings them low is when they hear that whistle blow. This is just a story old, death and dust and lust for gold, with a hero brave and bold, called the whistleblower. Whistleblowers have no choice, conscience makes them raise their voice, when they do I say rejoice, for the whistleblower. And Ludlow tends to Peterloo. Tyrants do what tyrants do. Only thing that brings them low is when they hear that whistle blow. Whistleblowers stand before hounds from hell and dogs of war, trained to guard with tooth and claw secrets of the schemers. And they impale the truth by thorn, nail the hands of those who warn, treat all sacrifice with scorn, crush the hopes of dreamers. And Ludlow tends to Peterloo. Tyrants do what tyrants do. Only thing that brings them low is when they hear that whistle blow. Whistleblowers sing out loud, wake the whole damn sleeping crowd. Truth will grow in soil you've plowed, where truth is a stranger. When the darkest arts of power bite the stem that holds the flower, freedom needs the seeds you shower when its life's in danger. In a world controlled by knaves, nothing's clear and fear enslaves. freedom sinks below the waves. Almost without knowing, whistleblower, we need you. Shake our chains to earth like dew. Speak for many ruled by few. Keep your whistle blowing.
Welcome back to Part Deux of the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. So we have Mel Goodman on the line. And one of the reasons why we have Mel is that I posted on Facebook, Pompeo's IG has been fired. It was always more than walking his dog and picking up his laundry. We chat with Mel Goodman. And why do we chat with Mel? Because Mel is a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University, a former CIA analyst. He is the author of Failure of Intelligence, Decline and Fall of the CIA, National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism, and a whistleblower at the CIA. In other words, he's the perfect person to talk about, not just Pompeo, but everything that we've been seeing under this administration. So let me welcome back to the program, Mel Goodman. How are you, Mel?
Thank you, Arnie. Good to be with you. And let me just add one thing before we start. If you want to encourage your guests to get someone to sit down with Joe Biden about the environment, you also should get someone to sit down with Joe Biden about the defense budget and about these attacks on China. We don't need bipartisan support for more defense spending and bipartisan support for bashing China. This is not what we need right now.
Exactly.
I hope someone's educating Biden on these issues.
And also about opposing the idea that Israel should annex any parts of the West Bank.
Yeah, well, some people say that's why Pompeo went to Israel, but I don't think so.
Oh, yeah.
I think he went to Israel because he's worried about China.
This whole story, you have two pieces. One is about the New York Times, and I think it's more about the quote-unquote Obamagate, what should be on the front page of the Times, and that Donald Trump is basically...
Yeah, that's a piece about false equivalence in the mainstream.
Right.
Mainstream
false
media
right.
does a terrible job.
Right, thank right. And that's important.
And you.
I want to end the show with that, because I do think that Donald Trump is brilliant at knowing how to manipulate the media. And then the media, as you point out, false equivalencies, they end up leading with what Donald Trump has done. He set a trap.
Yeah.
And they not only fall into the trap, they give it a headline.
They help it. They give it legs.
Yeah,
and then by the time they realize what they've done, there's a new trap.
Well, but you know what this is? This is how he won the 2016 election.
Exactly.
How many billions of dollars in free media did he get?
Yeah.
Because nobody thought that he would ultimately win.
Yeah.
They thought, well, he's good for ratings. It's no big deal.
Yeah, the problem was
such
Russian,
a no big deal. Now what we have is the
liar. It wasn't Russian hacking. That was normal political influence operations. The problem was the way the mainstream media covered Donald Trump.
And isn't it stunning that the mainstream media is doing the same thing again? Haven't they learned anything in 4 years?
No, exactly. This was Peter Baker, who's an accomplished journalist, who's their leading White House correspondent. Of course, now he's not responsible for putting it on the front page. That's an editorial decision. I mean, when editorial boards meet, they have to decide the lead article, the second lead, above the fold, below the fold. Well, they put that on the front page above the fold. And it was in the headline, the subheadline.
No, let me back up because people don't understand what we're talking about. So I want to make sure they understand. The piece you wrote was a counterpunch. It was entitled How the New York Times Enhances Trump's Propaganda. And what you do is this false equivalency. You talk about a story that appeared on I don't know what page and then what appeared on page one. And you point out that the story that appeared on page 7 or 8 or 9 should have been page one. Instead, this faux news, this made up stuff, the
exactly.
stuff that Trump knows is titillating.
Yeah.
He understands titillation better than anyone else, I think.
Oh,
and the problem is that the New York Times basically buys it. So why don't you explain the two stories so that we understand why the Times screwed up?
Right.
Because by giving them the headline, they give him just more traction and, as you said, more legs on this fiction.
Okay, on page 9, they put the story of the firing of Dr. Rick Bright. Here is Rick Bright, who's head of the Bureau for the Development of Vaccines, whose job it is to try to develop a vaccine for COVID-19, who doesn't play this game that Trump wants to play with hydroxychloroquine, which he now says he's taking. Maybe that could be good news, who knows. But he knew this was a political stunt. These were Jared Kushner's buddies in the business world who were promoting this drug. There's no evidence that it works. And now we have a lot of evidence that it doesn't work, that people are dying, the Veterans Administration. But when Trump was told about the tests, that was done at the Veterans Administration, he said, well, they're not my people. These are the veterans of the United States military. What do you mean they're not his people? And we're seeing tests that were done in Europe on hydroxychloroquine matched with the Z-Pak and taking zinc. I mean, these are things that are just not work. These are shortcuts that aren't the answer. So they put that on page 9, and on page 1, they put this absurd charge about Obamagate. And when he was asked about Obamagate to identify what were the crimes, he said, you know what they are, just read the newspaper. Well, what are they? There are no crimes. And just today, just to show the personal peak of the guy, he's not going to allow a ceremony at the White House for the portrait of President Obama, which every president has done for the last 40 or 50 years, to have a ceremony when you unveil the portrait of the previous president. So he has targeted Obama. He's obsessed with him because of the fact that he's an African-American, probably yeah, just drives Trump up the wall. He is a racist and a sexist and every other ist that you can think of. So we dig a deeper and deeper hole in this country. When I think of the role that the United States should play internationally in leading the international community to deal with what is a global crisis. This is where globalization is needed. So where is the UN? Where's the Security Council? Where's G7, the G20? Where's the IMF, the World Bank? Because poor countries are really going to be suffering from this disease because they don't have a public health industry. They can't afford to have. And this is where the United States has always played the leading role. It's kind of interesting that Xi Jinping went to the World Health Organization, something Trump wouldn't do, of course, and made a commitment of $2 billion.
Well, but what did Trump say? He's pulling out. It's not just he's cutting their budget. So you go, Xi Jinping, I mean, once again, what Trump is doing is he's opening the door and he's saying, okay, here's the vacuum. China, come on in. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, and so even as he bashes China, he's enhancing China's power.
Yeah.
Oh, it's just it's incredible. But your statement to the New York Times is so important. And the New York Times doesn't need sales. They're doing better now than they've ever done before. You know the story about newspapers. If it bleeds, it leads.
Bleeds.
Okay, yep. That's the story. I used to write for the Boston Globe.
TV news is worse.
I totally agree with you, but given what they're doing. Not only do they enhance the lie, not only do they give the lie legs, not only do they give Donald Trump even more free media than he deserves, but the stories that are life and death, these are life and death stories are on page 9, and lies and fiction are on page 1.
Well, and get to the other major instrument in the press community, the Washington Post. Look at all the support the Pentagon gets from the Washington Post. Support for the Space Force. We don't need a Space Force in this country. We need to demilitarize space. We're more dependent on space than any other country in the world. But George Will has written an article supporting the Space Force. David Ignatius has written an article supporting the Space Force, which has a $15 billion appropriation in this year's defense budget. So wherever you look, you get this support for this military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned about in 1961 when he left the office. And if he had had his druthers, he changed his mind at the last minute, he would have said military-industrial congressional complex because there's too much bipartisan support. You know, where are the critics when we really need them? Where's Daniel Patrick Moynihan when we need him? We need gadflies now, and we don't have them.
Not only do we need gadflies now, but the pandemic has redefined what it means to be secure. And what we're finding out is that all the nukes in the world, you know, and running to my basement aren't as terrifying as this.
That's this.
And what we're finding, I mean, so in a lot of ways, what we are redefining is what we crave, which is this idea of national security. What we crave is the idea that there's someone that has our back. Who we want to have our back isn't a general, it's a doctor. You know, who we want to have our back, you know, isn't a bomb, it's a virus, it's a pill for the virus. I mean, when you begin to realize this, again, we were just talking about alternative energy, that now is the time to have the conversation. Again, there's a horrific blessing to this pandemic, because not only has it exposed the rot of crony capitalism, and part of crony capitalism is the military-industrial complex. Let's understand that is crony capitalism, you guys. That is not about security. It's about profit. It's about building things people don't need. People didn't even ask for them and we're building them. And then on top of that, we're finding out that by shoveling so much money into it, it is making us less secure to put the money into an economy that desperately is going to need it as a result of being devastated by this pandemic.
And whenever
there's a reason to cut the budget, it would be now.
And whenever you have a presidential election, you're going to have more exaggeration of the threat. You know, when did you have the bomber gap? When Eisenhower was facing re-election. Fortunately, he didn't buy into it, but Kennedy bought into the missile gap.
Yeah.
And you got a new round of the arms race. You got it with Ronald Reagan when he brought down the Harvard professor, Richard Pipes, and his neoconservative ideas. And now you're getting Trump, with the support of Biden, fighting over the nature of the threat from China. There is no threat from China. China isn't looking for a confrontation with the United States. They're too smart for that. They're too busy investing around the world. They're building the Belt and Road Initiative. They're not fooling. They're not sending military forces all over the world. They're not building bases all over the world.
Right.
They have one outpost outside of the Chinese mainland itself, and that's in Djibouti to help us with international piracy. You know, China is prepared to be a stakeholder, and we're kicking them out the door. It makes no sense whatsoever. And that's why the international community has stopped paying attention to Donald Trump.
Well, but I understand. So what is Joe Biden drinking? That Joe Biden is now feeding into this sort of China bashing? Because, you know, I don't understand what it is that he is seeing as an opportunity for him. Let Donald Trump do that. Redefine relationship. Redefine security. Redefine making things. I get it. But you know what? It isn't China that created the idea that all these companies should move offshore. It wasn't China that created the idea that you could make something cheaper with a widget and screw the American worker. I hate to break it to you. China may be the beneficiary of it, but for the most part, it was our economic policy that actually enhanced those jobs disappearing and supported the concept of that. To blame China or Vietnam or whomever for being the place that ultimately got those jobs and ultimately realized the opportunity and the benefit from it, it didn't start with China. It started with our economic policy.
Well, when China wants to do the right thing, we fight them. China had all this surplus foreign currency. We're fighting wars with money that China provided for us. So they have all these U.S. treasuries, over $1 trillion worth. So they decided to start their own investment and infrastructure bank in Asia. We fought it. Now, we fought it unsuccessfully, but that's what we should have wanted China to do, to invest in the economies of Asia. When Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, she negotiated the Trans-Pacific Partnership. She said that was the best economic trade deal ever negotiated. When she ran for president, she said it was one of the worst deals. And she was in favor of abandoning it, which Donald Trump did. So the 11 countries that were going to sign up with us, they went ahead. So now there is an alternative trade bloc to China, and we're not even a part of it. We're not even competing with China the way we should be. Now, once upon a time, China was only 1 or 2% of the gross national product of the global community. Now they're 16, 18%. They're not going to be, they can't be contained. They are a regional power and probably a global power. And they have a sense of vision with the new Silk Road, and they have an economic presence and a social presence, and they've responded. Maybe they made mistakes in dealing with the pandemic at the outset, but they tried to correct some of those mistakes. They're sending,
you know, let me just say
sending equipment all over the world.
I'm not going to defend China. I mean, it's an you know, authoritarian country. I understand that they intimidate everyone, but every country tries to hide these kinds of things. I mean, it's not unusual. What China did when was maybe a little more horrific than most, but it's not uncommon to go into denial, to somehow marginalize it, to make it less important than it is. Look at Donald Trump. It's only one person. Keep the boat offshore, because if the boat comes on shore, we'll double the number of cases. Tell me how Donald Trump's reaction to COVID-19 was so different from the reaction of Xi Jinping. I mean, I hate to break it to you, that's what leaders do initially, is they don't want to embrace
the problem. But the sad thing about Trump is he was warned by the CIA as early as January the 10th and got 11 or 12 different briefings in January or February. It didn't come around to the middle of March. How many people died who didn't have to die during that period? Now, there was no way of stopping the crisis itself. There was going to be a crisis. It is a pandemic. It has to be taken seriously, but not 100,000, which is what the figure will probably approach by Memorial Day, when our great Vice President Mike Pence said it'll be over.
Yeah, exactly.
It'll be over Memorial Day. That's when we'll pass the 100,000 mark, but to Pence, it'll be over.
So you wrote a piece, and it was about Trump's war on truth. And it's now more than truth. It's. I mean, we know he lies. I mean, he does not have the capacity. He's not dishonest.
It's his best weapon.
Oh, yeah, of course it is. Well, first of all, he's not dishonest. He's ahonest. He doesn't even have the honesty capacity. I mean, let's be honest here. And not only does he lie, but the beauty of a lie is, since the lie isn't based on facts, it can change every 15 seconds. So what you said yesterday, 3 hours later, you can say something different because, after all, it wasn't based on facts anyway. So because you're making crap up.
At the rate he's going, we're going to have an unpredictable past. Forget the future.
Exactly right. So, but the problem with that is what you then point out and what I actually did yesterday. So we always begin our show with the powerful testimony of Colonel Vindman in 2019. But I had happened to see something at Forbes where Forbes listed the number of people that have been fired by this president since the impeachment trials. I mean, the list is just mind-blowing. But actually, you actually parallel the list in your piece. And of course, it begins or ends with the firing of Colonel Vindman, okay? And that's the other problem, is that it's not only his lies, and that his lies are causing us such economic and human havoc, but it's the fact that anytime anyone sort of either acknowledges a lie or sees a failure within the administration, then that person becomes a target and that person is gone. And that means there is no accountability, Mel, none. And
well, he's going after the truth tellers, whether they're judges, whether they're editorial writers, whether they're inspectors general, whether they're intelligence analysts. And he has the Attorney General, Bill Barr, as his wingman, who's pointing his way with criminal prosecutions and the threat of investigations of the Central Intelligence Agency, of the Justice Department, of the FBI. And this is the real danger, because Barr knows what he's doing. He knows exactly what he's doing. He has this theory of the unitary executive, that the president can do anything he wants. And Trump says this over and over again: I'm the president, I can fire him. Well, no, he can't. He has to have cause. He has to have, there's 30-day notice. Linick has already been told he can't come back into the building to pick up his personal effects. He didn't get 30 days notice. He's gone. And is the Congress going to do anything about it? Now, Engels, the head of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, has a strong case he can make in defending Linick, because Linick was exposing the corruption behind the arms sales to Saudi Arabia, which Congress was trying to stop because of the humanitarian nightmare that was being created in Yemen because of Saudi Arabia bombing with American bombs of civilian sites like schools and hospitals. This would have been a huge issue. So you get rid of the truth teller, you shoot the messenger. So he did that at the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. He did it to the woman, Christy Grimm, who did a study of the hospitals to show that test equipment wasn't there, the PPE wasn't there. And when he found out about that, that was at a press conference. He doesn't know what these people do. And in fact, he said, what's his name? Well, it's her name, it's not his name. Linick, he's never met Linick. Bright, he fired Bright. He had never met the guy who's there to create the vaccine that will solve Trump's political problem. He had never heard of
it. Because he listened to his son. No. What did his son say? He said, the day after the election, poof, the pandemic will disappear. I mean, if you think that, then you don't need to know about a vaccine. Right. You don't need to know the guy.
You just have to pray for summer.
Oh, God.
It's simple.
Well, you know, God, yes.
Yeah. The question I have, Mel, and you alluded to it earlier. In fact, your whole article was about it. Why do people let him get away with it? Why do people pick up his BS and talk about it? Well, let's talk about what Trump said and how it's a lie. You know, if my 7-year-old says something that's complete BS, we don't sit around and discuss, well, maybe it's true, maybe it isn't. And the New York Times, whether it's on page 9 or on page 1, should not be talking about it either. You're right. It's partly the people, the editorial policy of putting it on page 1, but also, why is anybody writing about Trump's latest idiotic idea.
Well, this is their version of what objectivity is and balance is. It's on the one hand and on the other hand without ever coming.
But is it? Is that what truth is about? Is that what reality is about?
No, but it's Trump's truth. And Trump has been very effective in getting his arguments out there under the guise of truth or reality. He's created new standards for journalism.
I know he's not as dumb as he appears, but why is he able to best all of these people who are rational and intelligent? Why can't they find a way to shut down his ability to make it look like there's an even playing field between his ideas and the truth?
Why is the Republican Party afraid to challenge this man?
Exactly.
Why is the public, his favorability ratings, it's not that they're great, but they haven't changed in 2 years, even with this pandemic. It's still, he still has 45% approval ratings. How could this possibly be in a rational society?
Here's the dilemma. The dilemma is his title. He is President of the United States.
He's got the power of incumbency.
Exactly. And so when my kids would lie, here's what I would do. I'd wash their mouth out with soap and I'd send them to their room, okay? And it was over. And we wouldn't discuss it forever. But they were my kids. They were not the president of the United States.
Well,
they're incredible authority and power. And frankly, he's able to corrupt the system in a way that, so how, I mean, I guess I'm trying to figure out is, do you say Obamagate or do you say he's lying again, using this as his task? I mean, I'm just trying to figure out what is Obamagate gives it credibility. Even asking that question gives it credibility. If it's a freaking lie, if
just
it's being made up, if it's done to
using
manipulate.
The term in any context. You know, most people read newspapers by standing at a newspaper stand, reading the headlines, and then walking away. I mean, how many people really read the newspaper these days?
I know, and
the dumbing down of America is part of this problem.
Well, and that the headline writer is the most powerful and potent guy at any newspaper, and unfortunately, what they're being tasked with is not doing triaging the truth. What they're doing is not looking at what is the story the American people need to hear. What they're doing is says what will catch their eyes, what will do the clicks. What will do whatever. We've got this profit motive.
Well, let me give you an example. The office of the inspector general is a very important position. And it was put in place to do this kind of oversight, to do verification, to do monitoring. And there are laws that protect the inspectors general. But in the New York Times, the position and the legality of the position was described as murky. No, it's not murky. He's appointed by the president. He has the statutory influence of the presidential appointment, and he can't be replaced by the head of the agency. He can only be replaced by the president of the United States, but for cause.
When Pompeo
said he wanted the guy fired, Trump had to say, what's his name? I don't even know who he is. What are the issues? But then he found out he was appointed by Obama. That's not cause, but that's all that Trump needed to know to fire him.
Let me ask one quick question, because in a way, I got to ask this. How did the story about the firing of the IG happen where initially we were told it was because he walked Pompeo's dog, he picked up the laundry, they went out for Chinese. They were doing all these things that were marginal at best, that really weren't the responsibility of the staff at Pompeo's office. And then 48 hours later, we find out, well, maybe that wasn't the big story. Maybe the big story was violating Congress's desire.
By then, it's too late. You know, when Bill Barr wrote his letter describing the Mueller report, 48 hours later, we knew it was one lie after another. It's too late. The window is closed on that story.
They did it again to us. That's exactly what I thought. This is what Barr did when the Mueller report came out. We were basically told a fiction. And then when the report came out,
and
we went,
ugh. And poor Robert Mueller has never been heard from since.
Yes.
But how did it succeed, Mel? How could it possibly have succeeded?
Because people don't have numerous. Look, someone on Mueller's staff should become a whistleblower and go to the press and make it clear what happened to the Mueller report, what Mueller intended, and what was in the report and how it was misused. Someone of some authority, some influence, some high position within the Mueller group. But why hasn't anyone done that? What are they afraid of?
I know.
What are they worried about at this? Why do you have so few whistleblowers? And now I'm amazed, given the way we treat whistleblowers in this country, it's amazing that we have any of them at all.
We have any, yeah.
Yeah.
Look at this poor CIA whistleblower. I've decided that the Kennedy School of Government with the Profiles in Courage, it should be every IG. Okay, every one of them should get a Profiles in Courage. And then I'll do a GoFundMe page. And I'll make sure that they have a retirement package. I just want, I'm going to put them on, you know, the Daily Show and the show. I'm going to make them like a face that everyone knows. No one ever knew what an IG was. It's not a murky job. You didn't know it because they did their job. The only reason why you know it now is because they're being fired because they did their job.
You have them because it's the only way Congress can do its job. They need that internal oversight.
But I wouldn't worry about them getting another job, Arnie. They'll do fine.
Well, no, but I want them to be household names. I want people to understand what is an IG. It is not a murky job. It is an essential job.
Yeah, people need to understand that this is important stuff.
I need to let Mel Goodman go, but we love talking to him. He is a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, professor of government at Johns Hopkins University, and a former CIA analyst. And if my blood pressure was high when we started, it's even higher now.
Oh, higher.
Thank you, Mel Goodman. We'll talk soon.
Okay, hydroxychloroquine, whatever you do.
Yeah, no. I don't do drugs.
Oh, good.
All right, everyone. This is The Attitude.
Right, good being with you.
All right, ciao. This is Arnie Arneson with The Attitude. We'll chat tomorrow. Ciao.
Who are on the road must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry, so just look at them and sigh. Can't know the fears that your elders grew by, and so please help them with your youth. They see the truth before they can die. Teach your parents well, their children's hell will slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry, so just look at them and sigh.